Hi, this is Tom Dreesen. Tony Lozano's got a show in Chicago.
Welcome back to another edition of Nude Hippo, the podcast. I'm Tony Lozano. On this edition, we're talking to a legend. A legend, I tell you. This man has been around for a long time and has done amazing things. It's Tom Dreesen. We'll get into Tom Dreesen in a moment, but first I have to acknowledge one of the members from Anne Friends. I always get to pick one person from Anne Friends to come over here and help me produce this show, and this week, it's Kimmy Spoons.
Hello!
Do you know who Tom Dreesen is?
I do.
And you know this because you and I have produced an event with Tom. Who did you bring to that event?
I brought my parents. Yeah. I had my sweet mother who is a fan of his work and the people he's worked with.
I like you say the people he's worked with. You know,
I wanted let's to keep name, it a secret so that name, way you can say it.
Let's name drop that person, Frank Sinatra. He opened for Frank Sinatra. There's a gig. I mean, first of all, that man, Sinatra, not only a legend, but you don't mess with him, right? So you always want to be on the good side of Sinatra. So if you're with Tom, if Tom is with Sinatra, he's protected.
Is he part of the mafia? Like, just the way it sounds.
We're not going to say that.
Okay.
You know, he's a local boy. If you consider Harvey, Illinois, local.
Close to my hometown it is.
There you go. See? And so over 40 years ago, he left Harvey and man, this man has done so many things. It would take me forever to name all the things. Besides being the opening act for Frank Sinatra for many, many years, he was a comedy partner with Tim Reed from WKRP. These guys were the first comedy dual black and white team that ever existed. But they're not only the first, they became the only one. It never has happened again. Name another comedy team that's, first of all, name a comedy team. Stand-up comedy team these days, you can't.
I was going to say, I can't even think of any.
Right. They also wrote a book called Tim and Tom, An American Comedy in Black and White. He has had a long friendship with a guy named David Letterman, and plus he fights for father's rights. Well, we talk about all of this stuff and more. When I sat down with Tom Dreesen at Gibson's Bar and Steakhouse in Chicago.
The following is a Tony Lozano podcast, an Opie show on the Radio Misfits Podcast Network. This is Nude Hippo, the podcast.
All right, Tom. Tom Dreesen is with me now. Now, Tom, how long have you been in show business?
This is my 48th year.
Wow. Did you start off as a salesman?
No, I was a salesman.
Yeah,
but
is that the progression of getting out of the real world and going into showbiz?
Well, I came out of the service. I spent 4 years in the service. You know, I'm a high school dropout.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I went in the service. I got a high school diploma from the Navy, you know, from while I was in the Navy, and I went to junior college nights. And I came out of the service, and I'm doing... you know, I worked concrete. I wheel concrete in Harvey, where I grew up on the south side of Harvey, Illinois. I'm helping pour sidewalks and basements and wheeling concrete. And then I went from there to I worked for bricklayers and being a laborer, you know, and working construction. And finally, I went and took a job at a trucking firm, and I was loading trucks. I was a Teamster
union
guy.
So always manual labor.
Always manual, because I don't have a degree from academia, but I got a doctorate from the streets. You know, I grew up on the streets.
Right.
You know? So anyhow, and went from there, and then finally they gave me a job as a foreman. I dropped my Teamster card, and I became a foreman at this trucking company, Jones Motor, and then I was, I worked in the loading docks as a foreman on all the shifts. And then finally, I left there and I went and I sold life insurance for Columbus Mutual.
Uh-huh.
And that's when I was in the JCs, a civic group at the same time. And then that's when I wrote the drug education program, teaching grade school children the ills of drug abuse with humor. I did it as a concept they weren't teaching drug education at a college or a high school level, let alone at an elementary school level. So anyhow.
That your first entry in comedy, kind of?
Yeah, well, I met Tim Reed. Tim Reed
right.
became my partner in this drug education program.
Yeah, yeah.
And the program became so successful because we used to make the kids laugh all the time.
Right.
And then one day, a little eighth grade girl said, "You guys are funny. You ought to become a comedy team." And the thought of a comedy team intrigued us. America had never seen a black-white comedy team. So we became America's first black and white comedy team.
Yeah. Tim and Tom, who got to choose on whose name went first?
We were backstage in the kitchen. We had never been on stage before.
Yeah.
And we had written material we thought was funny for like 4 months, and we had to finally go do it somewhere. And there was a club on the south side of Chicago called the Party Mart Supper Club.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a jazz group there. Mm-hmm. We asked the guy, could we come up after the jazz group? And the owner said, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
He said, nope, no problem. And anyhow, so we're in the kitchen. We're pacing back and forth. We're scared to death. There was no dressing room, nothing like that, you know.
Right.
And the guy come back. He said, okay, I'm about to introduce you guys. He said, what do you want me to call you? We said, what are your names? We said, we're Dreesen and Reed. He said, you're Dresden and Red? We said, no. He said, you're Red and Dressed Down? I said, no. I said, just say Tim and Tom. You know, he's Tim and I'm Tom, you know. And so that, and it stuck.
And that's how it stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you guys, how long were you together performing?
Six years.
And is this true? You are the first black and white comedy team and still the only at that level?
Yeah, we were America's first black and white comedy team. History shows we were the last. We wrote a book a few years ago called Tim and Tom, an American comedy in black and white.
Yeah.
And now it's going to become a movie, you know.
Oh, that's awesome.
About a life, yeah.
That's awesome. Also, so I grew up watching you on many different venues. I knew you from Johnny Carson. What was your first experience coming out to The Tonight Show? How did you get picked? How did they find you? Where did that come about? Were you already a name at that point?
Or? No, absolutely not. You know, in those days, after the team broke up in 1975, I went out to the West Coast. The team broke up in the early 75. I went out to the West Coast and tried to get on at the Comedy Store.
Sure.
You know? I wanted to be a single now because the teams broke up. And wherever you went in America in 1975, people say, what do you do for a living? You say, I'm a stand-up comedian. The next question out of their mouth was, oh, yeah, you ever been on Johnny Carson?
Right.
If you hadn't been on Johnny Carson, in the eyes of America, you just weren't a comedian.
Yeah.
So you finally have to get a home base. I established myself at the Comedy Store. It took a while to get on there, and I finally did and became a regular. Then you start hounding all the TV shows to come and look at you.
Yeah.
And I'd hound the talent coordinator from The Tonight Show. His name was Craig Tennis.
Yeah.
And he finally came to see me after me pestering him for 6 months. And he liked what he saw, and he put me on. You know, he gave me my first break. And in those days, like I say, one appearance on The Tonight Show, your whole life changed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
One appearance, Freddie Prinze got a sitcom the next day.
Right.
I did one appearance, and the next day, CBS signed me to a development deal.
Oh, my goodness.
It was one appearance. I mean, that's how powerful the show was.
Yeah, yeah. Is it with comedians today, I think I heard you talk about this elsewhere, that comedians become, or I've heard this from other people too, comedians get too famous too fast, that they don't go through the lengthy process that you guys used to go through, that they're now given half an hour specials on Comedy Central or cable. Is the process, from what you can tell from comedians, from where you grew going through the process to today, is it that much different?
I think there's a lot to be said about paying dues, you know, because it seasons you and gets you prepared for, you know, working in front of small audiences and large audiences. It gets you prepared for the ups and downs, the rejections of show business. You know, there's something about paying dues that really helps a lot. You know, some people are lucky and they go from early stages of sitcom right into early stages of stand-up right into a sitcom.
Yeah.
And then other people might catch a movie or two. But if you're going to last for a long time as a stand-up comedian, a couple things you really need to be able to do. One is write material.
Yeah, yeah.
If you can't write material, keep renewing your material, keep refreshing your material, write new material, you're not going to survive real long. You know? And the other is that... you know, that you have to learn how to find who you are on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And that only comes from doing it.
Right.
You know, all comedians, Tony, start out emulating another comedian.
Sure.
You know, and so you go on stage and you're pretending you're that comedian because you know that works.
Right.
You've seen that work for George Carlin or whoever your hero is. When you're brand new, you do that. And then one night you let a little bit of you out, maybe in an ad lib or something.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't work, you go back into doing that impression of a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And then one night you let a little bit of you out and it gets a laugh.
Yeah.
And another night you let a little bit more of you out. And before you know it, you start developing into who you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Picasso said, try to paint like another artist. I dare you. He said, try to paint like another artist.
Mm-hmm.
You'll fail, but in failing, you'll find out who you are as an artist, you know.
How long did it take you to find you?
Wow, it took, I'd say a good year before I felt like I was really comfortable on stage as me.
Yeah.
You know, being, you know, not being afraid to be me out there, you know. You know, with the comedy team, it was a totally different thing.
Sure. Because
you played a character in and out of sketches. You played characters, you know.
Now, when you were starting off, I believe there is a show on Showtime, which are you a consultant for now? What's it called?
I'm Dying Up Here.
Yeah, I just watched it. And is it based on Pauly Shore's mom?
First of all, it's based on a book a guy named William Needleseeder wrote called I'm Dying Up Here.
Okay.
And he covered the strike. In 1979, the comedians in the West Coast went on strike at the Comedy Store, and I led them. Okay. And that's what the whole book is all about.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's based on the book. His book was based on the Comedy Store and based on Mitzi, Pauly Shore's mom and everything. But the show Showtime is not.
Okay.
I mean, they took the title.
Yeah,
but
that's
about all they took.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The woman that plays Goldie isn't Mitzi. It might be who you wish Mitzi was, or who wish Mitzi wasn't.
Right.
But it isn't Mitzi.
Okay.
You know, and
so they're taking liberties with the story.
Yeah, they're taking the stories and taking some dramatic license.
Yeah.
But what it is, I'm Dying Up Here, is not about. It's not a comedy.
Yeah,
it's a drama.
Yeah,
it's about the dark side of comedy, about what young comedians go through trying to make it in this business. And it takes place in 1973. You know?
Yeah, it's a period piece. Isn't it true, though, that most comedians have very tragic stories in their background, which is what makes them funny? Not all, but a lot.
I've always said 85% of all stand-up comedians are insecure, neurotic, sometimes psychotic, loved, starved, wrecks. And the other 15% are gifted, confident people who say, I know how to write a joke and I know how to tell one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then I always say, I like to think that I'm in the latter, but you never trust somebody who tells you they're sane. You know?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
But, you know, so they do have, and probably that's what makes them funny.
Yeah.
But the tragedy is I've known five stand-up comedians who committed suicide.
Yeah.
You know, five.
Yeah.
Good comedians.
Yeah,
Robin Williams, Freddie Prinze.
Yeah, yeah.
Richard Jenny, one of the funniest guys I've ever met in my life. Ray Combs.
Yeah.
Steve Lebetkin. I mean, you know, and not to mention how many comedians destroyed their lives through drugs, narcotics, or alcohol. You know? So it can be on the dark side, you know.
Right.
On the positive side, it's the greatest profession on the planet, you know.
Sure.
To make people laugh and you make a living. You know?
And you're your own boss.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's really, I mean, you get to control your destiny to a certain degree on what the fans like and where you get hired. But really, as long as you hustle and you got the gig right, I mean, that's, but it's a very lonely gig too, isn't it?
It's stand-up comedy is the highest of highs and the lowest of lows.
Yeah.
When it works, I can't describe to you what it was like going out in front of 20,000 people when I opened for Frank Sinatra, but they came to see Frank. I don't want to think they came to see me. But to have 20,000 people and you got them.
Yeah.
In the palm of your hand, you got them. They're on a roll, boy.
Right.
And it's stuff you wrote. You wrote it and you produced it and now you're performing it and you got them.
Yeah.
And you got them on a roll. And now, and when it ends, the highest of highs, you know, and the opposite of that is when it doesn't work is the lowest of lows. You know?
Well, I would also imagine that you're up there on stage, you do, and this is throughout your entire career, depending on where you are, you're up there on stage, you perform. And then when you're done, you could be in the car by yourself, just driving. And especially if you're a road comic, just driving alone. So you go from being surrounded by, you know, tons of people to just yourself.
Oh, you know, I don't know how many times I've done two or three shows in Vegas and the crowds are just great and the roar of the crowd and you boom and people backstage and taking pictures and signing autographs. And then the next thing you know, you're in your hotel room and you're all alone and it's quiet, you know.
Right.
I remember working. The place we're sitting at right now used to be called Mr. Kelly's in Chicago.
We're at Gibson's right now.
We're at Gibson's Steakhouse in Chicago. This was Mr. Kelly's.
Yes.
And in fact, these were the dressing rooms up here where we're at right now. And anyhow, I remember you go down and it was opening night at Mr. Kelly's and all the press and all the media is there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot of pressure because it was my first time appearing here after the comedy team broke up. And you're worried, you're pacing the floor, and all the critics are out there, and you're scared that they're going to say, this guy isn't funny. He was funny with the comedy team, but he's not funny alone.
Sure.
And you go out, and you kill.
Yeah.
And backstage comes the press and the media and tell you, you were great, you were wonderful, and the audience went real good, and blah, blah, blah. And now they're all gone, and you're sitting in that dressing room all by yourself, and you're thinking, I got him. I really, really got him.
Right.
And you're sitting there, and all of a sudden, here, 5 minutes, Mr. Dreesen, you go, oh, I got to do this again.
That's right.
That was just one crowd.
That's right.
You didn't. All you did was you proved that one crowd. Yeah. Now you got to prove it again.
Oh, absolutely.
And again and again and again, night after night, week in and week out, year in and year out, all across the land and every different part of the country.
Yeah.
You know, you got to prove yourself every night. Dick Shawn once said, most people live from day to day. Mm-hmm. A singer lives from song to song, mm-hmm. and a comedian lives from joke to joke.
Yeah.
Your option comes up at the end of every joke.
And the difference between musicians and comedians, musicians could play their songs forever. People want to hear those classics. You can't be doing classic jokes, Tom. They don't want to hear it over and over again. So you got to constantly belt out new stuff.
Keep them new stuff. Frank Sinatra hired me because he wanted me to keep doing new material because he wanted a comedian because we went to the same cities every year.
Yeah.
You know, and so the people would, you know, if, but Frank,
yeah.
you know, if he didn't sing My Way every night,
right.
you know, they'd be mad if he didn't sing, you know, Chicago when he came here, right. My Kind of Town, you know, but he could sing the same song 20 nights in a row and you'd still love it. But the comedian, boy, after the second time they've seen you and you're up there, they say, we heard that one. Come up with a new one, you know.
Now, I know you had pinch yourself performing before Frank's show and hanging out with him and all that. But at the opposite end, how do you keep yourself humble? How do you keep yourself grounded in situations like that?
Well, you know, that's the other thing, too. I had eight brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. You know, we grew up in a shack
yeah.
in Harvey, Illinois. Five of us slept in one bed at one time. We were raggedy right. poor. You know, we had no bathtub, no shower, no hot water.
Mm-hmm.
A rat-infested, roach-infested shack. I shined shoes in taverns from the time I was 6 years old till I was 12. I set pins in bowling alleys.
Mm-hmm.
I caddied in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
I sold newspapers, all to feed my brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
I don't think you can grow up that way.
Yeah.
You know, I spent
yeah.
4 years in the military without being humble.
Yeah.
You know, I think I always tell comedians, I give motivation speeches to corporate America,
mm-hmm.
to colleges, to universities, to high schools, but I also give them to comedians. And I talk on four subjects, visualization, self-talk, perception, and develop a sense of humor. But I always tell comedians when I do one specifically for comedians, it's called The Joy of Stand-Up Comedy and How to Get There.
Mm-hmm.
But I write on the blackboard, arrogant / humble.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be arrogant enough to believe that you can go out in front of a group of strangers and make them laugh.
Yeah.
And you got to be humble enough to appreciate the hell out of it
yes.
when they laugh.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, I think, the two, you know, characteristics you really need to survive, you know.
With so many siblings, how did you stand out being a comedian? I'm talking about just growing up. Were you the funny one in the group?
Yeah, I was truly of the family because I love hearing the sound of laughter. When I was a little boy shining shoes in all the taverns, the owner of a tavern, Frank Polizzi, owned the tavern, was my mom's sister's husband.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved telling jokes. He told jokes behind the bar all the time. And I emulated him. I really thought, I was fascinated as a little boy when I would shine shoes in all the taverns.
Mm-hmm.
And I would always come to his tavern last. Wait for the shifts to change in the factory.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd go there last because my mother was a bartender there
mm-hmm.
and because he would be telling jokes behind the bar. And it fascinated me that with his inflection, with his vocabulary, his vernacular, he could cause the sound to come out of everybody's body that would fill the room like electricity
uh-huh.
and unite all these people. They'd be united, just all in unison laughing. It fascinated me
yeah.
that somebody could do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I used to tell his jokes, many that shouldn't be told on a Catholic school playground, you know. And years later, I wrote a poem called The Sound of Laughter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to do it for you, but the opening line is, as far back as I can remember, or shortly thereafter, I love to hear the sound of laughter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then it goes on and on
mm-hmm.
and on. But,
mm-hmm.
So I gravitated to it. So I always enjoyed telling a joke, but I never thought I'd be a comedian.
Yeah.
You know, when I was in the service, you know, I was the guy that always made everybody laugh.
Sure.
Or I could see, when I was a bartender,
mm-hmm.
when I first came out of the service and I was a bartender, you knew the characteristics of the customers
mm-hmm.
and all the other customers knew those characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
So I could create a joke about Tony.
Right, right.
And Tony was in here the other day and tell this funny, and original stuff and people
yeah.
would laugh and say,
yeah.
Tony would say, I didn't do that, but it sounds like something I do, you know, that kind of stuff.
And so how about your parents? Were you able to make them laugh?
Yeah, I remember.
Did they have a sense of humor? Did they?
My mom.
Yeah.
I remember when she was real ill. It turns out she went to the hospital with double pneumonia. But we were trying to cheer her up, and my sisters dressed me up.
Yeah.
like Bob Hope and like Bing Crosby. I was just a little boy, had the big old coat on, you know, and a hat. It belonged to my dad. And I went and they'd say, you know, ladies and gentlemen, welcome Bob Hope. And I'd walk out and I'd do like a joke. And then I'd go out and come back in and I'd sing a song, you know, and sure. I remember my mother laughing so hard, yeah. You know. And if I close my eyes, I can still hear her laughter.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, yeah, she's been gone for years. But, but I mean, so that might have been an influence on me, you know.
Yeah. Let's hit on Frank Sinatra. How did you get to be with Frank?
I was looking for a singer to close for me.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And this young lad.
It came out of being glib at the right time. Yeah. I, you know, I had... I'd been touring for years. After I did my first Tonight Show, I toured with Sammy Davis Jr. for 3 years.
Yeah.
And then I toured with Smokey Robinson and Natalie Cole and Gladys Knight and the Pips. I toured with Tony Orlando and Dawn and Mac Davis and Frankie Avalon. Yeah. Different artists.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was touring with Smokey Robinson, and we were at Caesars in Lake Tahoe. And Frank was appearing next door at Harrah's.
Yeah.
And I had worked Harrah's many times. So after the show, my show one night, I wanted to see Frank's show. So I told them, Major D and everybody, I was coming and say they saved a place for me. So I bolted off the stage and I rushed over to Harrah's Hotel and I was running into the showroom because I didn't want to miss Frank's opening, you know.
Yeah.
As I was going into the showroom, the vice president of Harrah's Hotel, a guy named Holmes Hendrickson,
mm-hmm.
very powerful guy, was talking to a big heavyset guy with a cigar. And he saw me running into the showroom and he said, Tommy, come here, come here. And I reluctantly went over there because I didn't want to miss the opening. And he said, Tommy, this is Mickey Rudin. Well, I recognize the name. That was Frank Sinatra's lawyer.
Ah.
Real powerful guy himself, you know. He said, Mickey, this is Tom Dreesen. I think Tom would make a great opening act for Frank Sinatra. And the lawyer got a pained expression on his face, like, you heard that a million times. He said, and he winked at the vice president, and I caught the wink. He said, hey, kid, if I gave you a week with Frank, would you want more than $50,000? I said, Mr. Rudin, put it this way. If you gave me a week with Frank, would you want more than $50,000? He said, I like this kid. He started laughing, you know. And a week later, I got a call to work with Frank. And I thought it would be one week.
Yeah.
At Golden Nugget in Atlantic City. And then I would, you know, try to get a picture taken with him and hang in every bar in Chicago and say, that's it. And what happened was the second night, he and his wife took me out to dinner.
Yeah.
His wife, Barbara. And I can remember like it was yesterday. We were eating dinner and he set his knife and his fork down. He said, you know, I like your material and I like your style.
Yeah.
I'd like you to do a few other dates with me if you're interested.
Yeah.
And I didn't say, let me check my calendar.
Right, you know?
I said, yeah. And it turned into 45, 50 cities a year for 14 years. And a friendship that I'll always treasure. I loved him. He was like a father to me. In the end, I was a pallbearer at his funeral and I spoke at his funeral. So, and I miss him every day of my life.
Oh, I imagine.
You're listening to Nude Hippo, the podcast. We'll be right back after this. Stick around.
This is Minutia Men with Rick and Dave.
On this week's Minutia Men with Rick and Dave.
Litigation dodgeball.
Cathedral putt-putt.
Nazi amusement park.
Warren G. Harding.
Celebrity potpourri with Rick and Mary Lou Henner.
And we interview one of the great celebrity rock and roll photographers, Mick Rock. All that in unlimited tangents on this week's Minutia Men.
The Tony Lasano Podcast and Opie Production on the Radio Misfits Podcast Network.
RadioMisfits.com.
Hi, I'm Howard Sudbury.
I'm Steve Baskerville.
On the next Back to You, a communications expert is going to try to teach Steve and I how to communicate.
And he says one important thing you better answer, and every audience wants to know, what's in it for me?
All right, that's on the next Back to You on the Radio Misfits Podcast Network.
And we're back. Now more of the interview.
Was there ever a chance where Frank, I mean, I would imagine, I mean, I'm sure you're recognized almost all the places you go to, but I can't imagine Frank walking out in the public and not being swooned. What was Frank like when there was no public, when there was no fans? Was he able to just relax?
Yeah, he was a guy from Hoboken.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's how we got along so well.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in saloons and taverns, you know, Shining Shoes and all the bars. I mean, his mom and dad owned a saloon called Marty O'Brien's Bar and Grill.
Yeah.
His father boxed under the name of Marty O'Brien because in those days there was so much prejudice against Italians.
Yeah.
They fought under Irish names.
Yeah.
And his father gained a little bit of popularity in the Hoboken area. So then one day opened up a tavern, you know, Marty O'Brien's Bar and Grill. And does it sound like we're in a restaurant?
Yeah, I know. It's fine.
Anyhow. You know, so we had that in common that we talked about You know, I had three children, a girl, boy, girl. Mm-hmm. He had three children, mm-hmm. girl, boy, girl. Mm-hmm. He once said, a guy from the New York Times said to him, why do you keep Tom Dreesen as your opening act? And he said, besides the fact that he's funny. And the guy said, yeah, yeah, besides the fact that he's funny. He said, well, if I'm a saloon singer, and I am, yeah. Tommy's a saloon comedian. Yeah. He said, by that I mean we're just a couple of neighborhood guys.
Yeah.
And I always treasure that quote because that's what I felt like when I was with him. He's a neighborhood guy. Yeah. He was Frank Sinatra, the yeah. big Frank Sinatra. But when you're alone with him like this, yeah. he was a guy. You know,
exactly.
Like anybody else. You know?
Yeah, because, you know, in my job, I have dealt with celebrities of all different stages, and I always observe the people that are with the celebrity. Sometimes it's a wife or a husband. Sometimes it's just a PR person. And I notice how they become invisible. Because yeah. everyone wants to meet the celebrity. So I yeah. kind of just talk to the wife or the husband. And,
yeah.
you know, have you ever had a chance where you can just go in the public and enjoy yourself without being recognized?
Oh, yeah. I mean, are you kidding me? I love it. I you know, I'm not really a big star by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. I traveled with a big star. Frank sure. I know a big star.
Yeah.
You know, I have had a lot of popularity yeah. in Chicagoland area, especially because I've done over 500 appearances on national television. Yeah. So I've talked yeah. about Chicago and, you know, growing up here yeah. and almost all of them, like being a Cub fan and all that stuff, you know.
And I even remember your TV show on Channel 7. You had a little talk show for a late yeah. night locally here.
It was a 1 week pilot. Yeah. We got big ratings and yeah. we for sure we were going to get yeah. picked up. But a guy from ABC did not want it to happen. A guy in New York. Turned out that it was a shame because I'd had my own talk show.
Yeah, that's a good
but,
show.
You know, I was a people person before I was a comedian. Yeah. I love people. I like being around people. Yeah. I was a bartender. Yeah. I was a salesman. Yeah. So, you know, I don't mind
yeah.
that. And when I come back home, people always, you know, come up again. I saw you on this. I saw you on that. And Chicago performers are like that.
Yeah.
You know, we're you know, we like people, and we're glad that people recognize sure. us and like us, you know. I'll give you a quick story on that.
Yeah.
A guy named Joe Ahern from Chicago here, who used to be head of CBS, yeah. and he was head of ABC mm-hmm. when I had my show. He's yeah. the one who got me my show.
Yeah.
And he is now head of the 100 Club. You yeah. know, they take care of the widow, the first responders who are killed in line of duty. They take mm-hmm. care of their family. Joe asked me one time, he called me out in California. I was in Sherman Oaks, California, getting a haircut. And Joe said, Tom, I want you to do a PSA, a public service announcement, for the 100 Club. I said, Joe, I'll call you back in an hour. I was getting a haircut. In 1 hour, I called him back. I said, I got Gary Sinise, Dennis Franz, Joe Mantegna, Dennis Farina, William Peterson, and myself. We're going to do it for you. Now, all five of those guys yeah. played a cop on the series, Dennis on Crime Story, mm-hmm. and Dennis was a Chicago cop.
Right, he was.
You know, Dennis Franz yeah. on NYPD Blue,
yeah.
Joe Mantegna, Criminal Minds, yeah. Gary Sinise, and William Peterson, CSI, mm-hmm. and I played a cop in a movie
yeah.
one time, you know. And so I said, I got all five of us,
yeah.
and we're going to come back, and we'll do a PSA. Well, Joe Mantegna said, Tom, you can use Criminal Minds set.
Yeah.
We'll do it there. And so not one of those guys said to me, call my agent, call my manager, right. call my lawyer. Right. All of them took my call, and yeah. within an hour, I had all six of them. That's what Chicago entertainers are about.
Yeah.
If I sat with those six guys in a restaurant, and we've done it at mm-hmm. Joe Mantegna's restaurant mm-hmm. in L.A., and somebody came up and said to Dennis Franz, gee, Dennis, I'm a big fan of NYTD Blue. He didn't say, look, we're eating. Can you right. talk? Right. Don't bother us. He'd stand up and shake their hand and say, yeah. thank you very much. This is my friend, Tom yeah. Dreesen. This is Dennis Farina. You know, that's how Chicago entertainers are. You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You were born on September 11th.
Ugh.
How has yeah. that changed?
It changed, you know, because it used to be a happy day
yeah.
to a very sad day.
Yeah.
You know, I remember it like it was yesterday. Everybody remembers mm-hmm. what they were doing that day. I was on my way to New York going to go see Joe Pesci. Mm-hmm. Pesci had a golf tournament. I was performing at his golf tournament, you know, and mm-hmm. And I was heading for the airport when it happened.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's become, you know, kind of a sad day. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
I'm sure December 7th for people many years ago, you know.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. Harvey has a street named for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the town that you grew up in.
Yeah.
That's kind of impressive, but Biondi has an alley named after him. Do you know about that? You know how Dick Biondi has an alley here
yeah,
in Chicago?
That's what I heard.
And he is so proud of the fact that it's an alley and not a street.
Yeah.
You go back with Dick Biondi as well, right?
Yeah, I knew Dick way back. He actually introduced us one time we were doing a gig, Tim and Tom. It was like our second or third time on stage.
Yeah.
And Dick Biondi introduced us. You know, I've known him that long.
Yeah.
Know? Yeah, he's a great guy. Dick.
I got to work with him the last 6 years previously. And just being with him and going and hearing his stories and begging him to write a book. And he's like, no one wants to hear these stories. I'm like, trust me, these are amazing stories. One time he was telling me a story about how something was happening and there was someone sitting on the couch and they were saying this. And then halfway through the story, he mentioned how Elvis was also on the couch. I went, wait, hold on. You didn't mention Elvis was in the room? Uh-huh. He goes, oh, that's no big deal. A lot of people have met Elvis. I'm like, no, really? A lot of people have not.
Yeah. Well, what happened, Tony, people vicariously live. I did. Yeah. Before I was ever in show business, yeah. If somebody from my neighborhood met somebody, met, you know, I used to be thrilled at the Harvey Holiday Inn if the drummer came off stage and knew me.
Yeah.
And he came up to the table and said hello. I thought, boy, that's pretty cool. That drummer came up and said hello to me. So, you know, they vicariously live through your stories, you know. And I know my friends back home, you know, they always wanted to know about Frank Sinatra, what it was like and all that stuff, you know. I had done, the interesting thing, I had done 60 appearances on The Tonight Show, over 50 on Letterman.
Yeah.
All the things that I've done in my career. But it's always Sinatra. Like the guys back in the old neighborhood, they'd say, yeah, I saw you on that show. I can't even remember the name of it. But when I started touring with Frank, they wow, that to them, that was a pretty big deal because they were all Sinatra fans. You know?
Finally, let's talk about David Letterman. You are you go way back with David Letterman as well, right?
Yeah, we started at the Comedy Store together.
Yeah, yeah.
He's my friend, and he's been my friend since way back in the day. I met him. I came off stage at the Comedy Store one night, and there was this guy with a red beard, you know, and he said, you're very funny, Mr. Dreesen, or something like that.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, thank you. I said, what's your name? He said, Dave Letterman. I said, Dave, where are you from? He said, Indianapolis. I said, oh, you know, I'm from Chicago. And we started talking sports, you know, baseball, basketball, and all that stuff. And then the next night, I saw him again. Hey, Dave, how you doing? And because I'm so outgoing, I kept taking it to him, not realizing how shy he was.
Right.
Had I known how reclusive and shy he was, I probably would have respected that and left him alone. But by the time I found that out, we were friends.
Just going to say, it's very rare that I hear people that were friends with either Carson or Letterman because they kept to themselves.
Very quiet.
And they didn't do the showbiz stuff and all that.
Yeah.
So that's why it's fascinating to find out, you know, that Letterman has a friend in you, you know.
Well, yeah, somebody else was, I was on a show a while back and a guy said something. He said, three of the most private people the show business has ever known are David Letterman, Frank Sinatra, and Clint Eastwood. And all three of those are friends of yours. Why? I said, I don't know why. I don't know. I said, maybe because I can keep a secret. Maybe because I made them laugh. I don't know. But I treasure all their friendships, you know, and I have, you know. But David is brilliant. You know, he's insecure, as most comedians are. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know how good he is and doesn't want to know how good he is. Yeah. Doesn't want you to tell him how good he is.
You're right.
You know, but he's been a friend. And I know that if I called him and said, I need you, he'd be there.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I like the fact that when you first met him, he had a beard and now he has a beard once again.
I know. it looks like he's going to be Santa Claus at Macy's this year, you know.
Let's talk about the Illinois Fatherhood Initiative. That's one of your big, I mean, you do, from what I can tell, hundreds of charities, but this is the one that you really.
Yeah, because it's a problem that Americans are going to have to face. I mean.
And what's the problem?
It's the destruction of America, the downfall of the family.
Mm-hmm.
That 40 million children in America today have no father in the home.
Mm-hmm.
3 out of every 10 white children born in America today have no father in the home.
Mm-hmm.
4.5, almost 5 out of every 10 Hispanic mm-hmm. have no father in the home. And 7 out of every 10 African American children have no father in the home. It's a crisis that's going to destroy the fabric of America,
well,
the family.
Well, what's the important part of having a father at the home? So
77% of all teenage crimes mm-hmm. are created by fatherless teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
77% of all teenage crimes. This year in Detroit, over 70% of the children being born were being born fatherless.
Mm-hmm.
So we're creating a nation full of criminals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Harvey, where I grew up at in 1960, 4% of the kids being born were being born without a father in a home.
Yeah.
Today in Harvey, over 70% are being born without a father in a home. And growing up, we were more afraid of our fathers than we were of the police.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
You know, men patrolled the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Men protected their neighborhoods.
Yeah.
You know, in Chicago, where I was in the Chicagoland area, if there was a Polish neighborhood, an Irish neighborhood, an Italian neighborhood, a Jewish neighborhood, a African-American neighborhood, if a young girl got pregnant, the minute that community would go out and get the guy and say, you're going to marry that girl. Mm-hmm. She said, no, I'm not. She said, yes, you are. She said, if you're not going to marry her, then you're going to take care of her financially, mm-hmm. take care of that child. Because if you don't, we have to.
Right.
You know, and then the government came along and said, oh, no. If you have a baby out of wedlock, we're going to give you $250. Yeah. If you have two babies, we'll give you $500. Yeah. If you have three babies, we'll give you $750. Right. By the way, three babies from three different men.
Yeah.
And if that man lives with you, cohabitates with you, then you're not getting any money at all.
Yeah.
So the federal government said, we'll take over the responsibility of the father.
Yeah.
And the men became absent from that community. Now, in the Polish neighbor, that Irish neighbor, that African-American neighbor, whoever, if there was a young boy roaming the streets, snatching purses and being a thug, the men of that community went out and got him and took him home to his father.
Yeah.
And he was more afraid of his father than he was of the police. One of the black guys I grew up with, a good friend of mine, I talked about him in my act and he's on my album and everything, Everett Nicholson, his nickname was Gucci. We were setting pins in a bowling alley coming home late one night, and the cops pulled us over because it was after curfew. And we told them we were setting pins, and they said, okay, they were going to give us a ride home.
Yeah.
And Gucci, who was one of the toughest guys I ever met in my life, he wasn't a mean street brother, but he was a tough guy.
Yeah.
Good football player, tough guy. He said, please, officer, don't take me home. If I come home in a squad car, there's going to be hell to pay.
Yeah.
You'll never see me on the street again, I promise you. You know, we're more afraid of our fathers than we were of the police. Men... that's what can save the fabric of America, for men taking over their neighborhoods again.
So what does the Illinois Fatherhood Initiative do to try to help change that?
Well, we honor fathers, and we have children, right? I mean, there's so many projects they do.
Yeah.
But every year we have a Father of the Year, and children, you know, 500 to thousands of children submit letters of why my father is the best father and all that stuff. We honor the fathers, and we talk about fatherhood. Yeah. Everywhere we go, you know, and talk to the communities, you know.
Yeah.
It's really a tragedy, you know, and you can't express it enough. The only way you can solve a problem is, first of all, admit that it's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you know what the problem is, then you have to attack it. The politicians of America have to come up and say, America, we made a terrible mistake.
Mm-hmm.
We thought... we knew what we were, you know, we thought we were doing right. We meant well.
Right.
But it failed. We've lost five generations of our youth now. But we can stop right now and start talking about morality.
Mm-hmm.
That when a boy, you know, men are as responsible for that child as that woman is.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if you don't glorify that.
Right.
You know, I was back in Harvey visiting, and I was standing on the street corner, and some people were talking to me, and a young thug came up to him, young gangbanger, and he was trying to bait me. You know, hey man, I don't know who you are. Who the hell you think you are? Mm-hmm. You know, people say you're somebody. I never heard of you. You're nobody to me. And I laughed and I kept talking, but somehow I kept him in a conversation. He started talking about children. I said, well, you have children?
Mm-hmm.
I got four babies, man.
Mm-hmm.
I said, that's good. He said, from four different women.
Yeah.
I said, oh,
yeah,
okay. And I said, yeah. I said, do you spend some time with the children? He said, when I want to bang the mama.
Yeah.
Now, when he said that, in my day, Gucci's father would have grabbed him by his ear and drug him home to his father and said, you know, your son just said,
right,
your son is this, you know, that's the difference of the mentality.
Oh, sure.
You know, and again, I keep going back to that you have to take over your neighborhoods.
Yeah.
The men have to take over their neighborhoods again and protect the neighborhood. The police can't do it all, you know.
I have a few theories. I grew up in the, I'm a single, my mom was single and she raised me. And lucky for me, I never did drugs. I'm not into alcohol, never smoked, never did any gangs. But, you know, my mom had her hands full, and it was the 70s. Tough time to be a single mother. Because this was right at the time, right after women's movement, and it was hard for her to get a credit card, hard to establish anything and all that. Times are different now. But back then, I had the park district programs. They had the wood shop. They had drama. They had gymnastics. Mm. All these things I joined. The schools had things.
Join them, or did your mother take
my
you
mom,
there?
My mom signed me up.
Yes.
But she got me interested in all this stuff. And that's how she kept me busy, so that she can work and still raise me and all that, along with my younger sister. But over the years, those programs have disappeared. The park districts don't do that as much. And if they do, they charge a lot. The schools, I remember in the 90s fighting with the Chicago media here when they were trying to cancel all after-school programs. And we were raising money to get that back going. But they're always cutting that. I think that's part of the problem, too, is that there's not the support system where, and this is going to sound weird, I believe that when women were allowed to work and things change, that took one of the parents out of the house. Now you have both parents working, and now you have kids with nowhere to go. Yeah. And we didn't adjust our schedules. We didn't take away the summer vacation that we don't need anymore. We didn't change after-school programs. So I think a lot of kids are also kind of running loose. So I think society has changed as well.
Well, I won't disagree with you there. You know, yeah. I disagree. But again,
I agree with you.
There have been single moms who've done an outstanding job. Right. I'm so honored. Yeah. You know, to meet those women when I meet them, that they really discipline their children and tell them. You know, but sometimes it's more than they can handle.
Oh, great.
That's why you'll have a grandmother who's raising those kids.
Yeah.
You know, and I always say there's a grandmother on the south side of Chicago. She's got four babies, grandbabies. Yeah. She's trying to protect them from the gangs.
Yeah.
And she's got a broomstick and they got an AK-47. Yeah. Who's going to win that fight?
Yeah, and that's part of the problem, too, is some of these neighborhoods are divided and segregated, and there's really seems to be no hope with anyone, and they get stuck in this vicious, there's a lot of problems.
Yeah, a lot. But again, you first have to recognize that it's a problem.
Absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely.
And the Illinois Fathered Initiative is doing something about that, and I'm proud to be a part of it.
And if people want more information on that, where do they go?
You can go to the website, Illinois Fathered Initiative. Yeah. A guy named David Hirsch, H-I-R-S-C-H, is the founder, and he does an outstanding job of keeping this going, you know. Moms are revered in our society, and they should be, you know. But fathers play such an important role.
Yeah.
You know, just such an important role. And usually it's you grew up without a father, But let me tell you, my father was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
But he was in the home.
Yeah.
And I remember playing basketball as a kid. I played a lot of sports. And I scored 28 points in a game in eighth grade, and we were going into the finals. And my sister went home. My father had never seen me play any sport, anything.
Yeah.
Never went to anything. He was always in the bars and the taverns. Yeah. And my sister went home and talked about the whole school's all excited. We're playing in the finals and all. And it was at Thornton High School. The elementary schools were playing in there in the finals. And so my mom went and got my dad out of a bar, and he was going to watch me play that night. And I didn't score. We got beat by about 32 points. We got just blown out of the gym. I scored 2 points in the whole game.
Yeah.
But the 2 points that I scored, it was like today would have been a three-pointer. It was like a 40-foot. I just fired it up at one point, and it went in. And when it went in, the first thing I did was turn to look and see if he was looking.
Sure, yeah.
That's the first thing it was in. Yeah. Did my dad see that?
Yeah.
And I looked, and he did.
Yeah.
And he did, and he was at a big grin on his face.
Yeah.
And like I say, if I live to be 100, I'll never forget that grin on his face, the impact that made on me. Mm-hmm. I wanted my dad to be proud of me.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that most boys would want that. Yeah. And if your father was disappointed in your thuggish behavior, you probably wouldn't do it, you know.
Yeah.
When thugs would come around, your father would walk out and say, no, not my son.
right.
Get the hell away from my house.
Yeah.
You know, and you'd, as much as you'd want to go with those thugs, he was your dad.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, not that your mom can't do that too, but again, it's important.
It changed my mom by being her becoming a dad, because my mom had to play both roles. So I know what you're talking about. She had to become a hard person. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, God bless her. She raised a fine young man.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it. I'm impressed with everything you have done. Many, many more years of success to you, my friend.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm a happy guy.
Thank you.
All right. So that was my interview with Tom Dreesen. And you had conversations with Tom as well.
I had a little bit. It was more like story time, where he told me some things about Frank Sinatra's wife and just how she was more powerful, it felt like. Like you wouldn't want to mess with her.
I don't think you want to mess with any Sinatras.
No, but it made it to where she called the shots more for Frank.
That's probably normally the case, if you ask me.
But it's nice to hear, especially because, like, the time frame.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
That's where it's like, I wish I met her.
Yeah.
More than anything.
Yeah.
After talking with Tom.
Well, if you enjoyed this show, subscribe. If you subscribe, you get the show for free all the time. You could skip it for free even if you don't subscribe, but it comes to you easier. You can do that on Apple Podcasts, on Stitcher, on Spotify, on the other ones, TuneIn, iHeartMedia. There's so many. Or wherever you get podcasts. How about we say that? And at Radio Misfits and opishows.com.
So many places to find us.
Check out the other shows on the Radio Misfits podcast network, like...
And Friends.
There's a fun show. It's with Kimmy, Tommy, and Sammy. I keep on going Sammy because I think it has a nice rhythm, but it's really Samuel.
It works.
Yeah, it does. And you guys talk about...
Basically the conversations that friends have. You can't really narrow it down because there's too many different things.
That's right. It's a good show. It's about 30 minutes long, and it's very engaging and entertaining. And you can find that at RadioMisfits.com. So I end this show how? Oh, I thank you. So, and from And Friends is Kimmy Spoons, who sat in and produced today's show. Thank you.
And a special thanks to you, Tony Lasano, with opishows.com. Opie is actually hippo spelled backwards. OPPIHshows.com. And distributor Ed Silla from RadioMisfits.com.
Until next time, from all of us here at Nude Hippo the Podcast, stick around.
Listen, subscribe, and rate Nude Hippo the Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeart, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Just search for Radio Misfits.
The proceeding was a presentation of Opie Productions. Find our other great shows wherever you find podcasts, including opishows.com. Thank you.
This has been a presentation of Opie Productions.
Tony, can you shut up?
Okay, Tony. I wish you the best. Okay? And if you need me, call me. If anybody hits you, give me a call.
I'm Mark Vernon. Join me and my co-host Luke Costable each week for the Car Guys Report, Informed Automotive, the podcast where two regular car guys talk about... What else? Cars. We'll tell you about what we've seen on the roads, what's happening in the industry, and share some great stories about our experiences in the automotive world over the past several decades. We guarantee it'll be fun, informative, and entertaining. It's the Car Guys Report, a Tony Lasano podcast, an Opie production on the Radio Misfits Podcast Network.